Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters with your host, Betty Jo Tucker, author of Confessions of a Movie Addict, right here at www.blogtalkradio.com.
How do you do? Mrs. Betty Jo Tucker feels it would be a little unkind to present this show without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold the story of Frankenstein, a man of science, who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning upon God. It is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It might even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now's your chance to, well, we warned you.
Hello, brave listeners. This is Betty Jo Tucker, and the warning voice you just heard belongs to horror movie expert A.J. Hockery, the Mad Movie Man. Although A.J.'s words were borrowed from the 1931 Frankenstein movie, we are actually celebrating the 100th anniversary of the first screen appearance of Mary Shelley's iconic monster, which occurred in Thomas Edison's 1910 film. And we're very fortunate to have Fred Weibel, Jr., author of Edison's Frankenstein, with us to talk about his terrific book and the movie itself. I'm also happy to report that Fred's publisher has generously donated three of his books to give away on our show, and I'll announce details of this drawing later. Hi, Fred. Welcome to Movie Addict Headquarters.
Well, I'm glad to be here. You know, I'm down to three movies a day. I used to watch them constantly, but I've had to cut back, you know.
So you belong on Movie Addict Headquarters.
Yeah.
I sort of suspected that after reading your book, and it's such an honor to have you as a guest. I'm completely bowled over by the amount of research you've done and all the actions that you've taken in connection with Edison's Frankenstein. So of course we have lots of questions for you, but first let's see if Nikki Starr and Jazz Shah are ready to help with the show. Nikki, is the chat room open now?
Yes, it is, and we are ready to go. Very excited about the giveaway. Very happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Nikki. It's we really do appreciate everything you do in taking such good care of our chatters, and we appreciate the people who signed up for the chat as well as all our other listeners. We hope everyone enjoys the show. I'm sure that they will. Thanks also to AJ and Jazz for agreeing to co-host. Jazz, are you as excited as I am about today's topic and guest?
It's one of my favorite topics. You know, I love the classics, and I will say we've been discussing Fred on Twitter this afternoon, and quite a few people showed up from there.
Well, thank you so much for doing that, and welcome to our show, tweeters. We're very, very glad to have you. AJ, I loved your introduction to the show. Thanks so much. And since you're our guest co-host today, why don't you start the ball rolling by asking Fred a couple of questions about Edison's Frankenstein?
Don't mind if I do. As most people know, the 1931 Universal Frankenstein is probably like the most famous Frankenstein of all time. It's gotten the most press. The critics love it. But Fred, why is the Thomas Edison Frankenstein such an important film?
Well, it really set the standard for those type of horror films. It showed that the creation scene of the monster is always the most exciting part of the movie. And that was definitely stressed in the Whale 1931 version and all the other versions after that. That's something you couldn't do on stage like you could in the movie. So I think that's why it was really important.
Oh, for sure, because I had where we were talking about in the pre-show, I just watched the Edison Frankenstein today, and that was one of the more impressive aspects of it, because even for like pre-code, like early days of cinema, that was some pretty freaky stuff, because you have the Frankenstein monster just sort of like in a state of like reverse decomposition as he's like, so like kind of like being put together, and it's a really weird effect.
Yes, it is, and that scene takes up the majority of the film. And
mm-hmm.
so that's what the people stress, that, you know, that watching this dummy that they made, I guess, out of paper mache, and they burned it. And as the dummy was burning, they filmed it backwards by either turning the camera upside down or back cranking the cameras, which were hand cranked in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it was developed, it would go, you know, you would see the thing form from just little ashes swirling around, and all of a sudden there's a skeleton and all. It's different than any other, you know, version of Frankenstein that's been filmed. But the special effects that they used there and in the film really cemented that most of these movies to come had to have some kind of a thrilling creation sequence in them.
I believe
yeah.
that's right, because most of them that you see, that's really a big thing in the movie.
Oh, yes. They build up to this climax, and then the actual creation of the life and you know, right there is the, you know, most exciting part of the movie, but then all of a sudden it sort of turns bad rather quickly.
That's right. AJ, did you have another question that you'd like to ask Fred?
Absolutely. Fred, how did you become involved with this movie, and how did you get to research it, and like, what kind of gave you like the spark of life to dedicate the whole book to this movie?
Yeah. Well, back when I was young, I guess I was maybe 11 or 12 back in 1963 or 4 when Famous Monsters magazine was all the rage amongst, you know, my friends of mine and I, that and Mad Magazine. But in one of those issues of Famous Monsters, they had a picture of a catalog cover from Edison that had a picture of the Edison Frankenstein on the cover. And they really didn't know much else about the film. Somebody had gone down to the Edison historic site in Orange, New Jersey, and they found in the logs of the studios that there was a Frankenstein movie, and then they found in the bound section of the old catalogs there it was. And I saw that, and then, you know, and then for 40 years I just wondered, you know, whatever happened to the movie. And I was always an Edison nut, because I, you know, Edison was one of my heroes as a kid, I collected his records and books and, you know, just about everything on Edison. And then
now, Betty Jo pointed out that you covered a lot of research, the background, not just the film itself and the quality of it, but the history of how it came to be and how it was rediscovered. Tell us a little bit, as you wrote about Al Detlef, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes,
and,
you are.
And how he happened to find the film.
Well, I saw a clip of it on on cable television when I was visiting my in-laws in Minneapolis. And I tried to track it down from there, and I said, you know, they showed this part of the creation sequence from Edison's Frankenstein, and I said, oh my God, I didn't know that any of this existed. So eventually I tracked down the name Al Detlef, who lived in Wisconsin and had the only known surviving print of the film. He actually had been showing it locally and was quite well known in the area. But outside of that, not many other people even knew that he had a copy of the film and had copied it and was showing a print at movie theaters in Wisconsin.
So it was just a local phenomenon out there? I mean, that he was just making money off of it and whatnot. How did he obtain it originally?
Well, he had been collecting films since he was a kid, and he used to show them in his father's basement down in the drugstore and give the kids a candy bar and charge them each a dime to see the movies. So over the years, he'd been collecting films, and he heard that his mother-in-law had some old films that she used to show while she had an act traveling around the area. And then he tried to track those down, and he found out that his brother-in-law had sold those films to another collector. So he went over there, and that collector had sold all those films plus all he had to another collector. So Mr. Detlef eventually found the person who had gathered all of the different movies together, and he bought them in a paper bag for $20 for the bag full of these old films. And Frankenstein was among them. So it was really just by chance that the thing survived that way. He took it home then and put it in his projector, but the film had shrunk, you know, like about 8 to 10%, he said, and it just started to tear in the projector, you know, so.
Oh, just deteriorated. Oh.
Yeah, it was just, it had shrunk, and the sprocket holes wouldn't line up with the, you know, with the projector properly, so he had to develop a different setup to be able to, you know, actually project the film or copy it. He made a 35mm copy off of the original film, except the original film was in tinted colors, but his copy was black, was sepia, sort of a brownish black and white process.
He was so protective.
Oh yes.
Of that film, I found that part of the book quite riveting. I mean, he just absolutely was obsessed
oh, yes.
with it, and it was incredible the things that he did to protect that film.
Oh yes, and that was just the tip of the iceberg, you know, because he was very, very protective, and when we actually showed the film at places, he wanted to have his thing projected on the screen saying "stolen from Al Detlef," in case there was somebody in the audience videotaping the movie. And it took me about 9 years to finally get him to release the film. And every time, you know, not just me, but many other people over the years have been trying to get him to, you know, put the film out on videotape and this and that, but he was making more money selling, you know, licensing these two-minute clips for documentaries and things.
And he
was afraid that if he actually let the film out, then since it's in the public domain, that it would just be bootlegged, quote-unquote bootlegged, or copied, and he wouldn't get any, you know, anything from that. So he was very, very particular about that. And every time it would come to the point where we were going to actually, or somebody was going to actually do a project and release it as a videotape, he would back out at the very last moment. So finally we got to this point where, and we're talking about 2003 now, where into the DVD age, and he had this opportunity to show the movie in New Jersey, Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is right in the vicinity of New York City. And also they gave him a table to sell his products at this giant 10,000 attendance horror film festival called Chiller Theater, which is over in the Meadowlands. And I finally convinced him, I said, well, look, this is your opportunity of a lifetime. You'll never, you know, be able to market it as well any other way. And this would be direct sales, and it would just be the best time. You're getting old now, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And they offered, the Fort Lee Film Commission offered to pay all his expenses. So, you know, I said, you know, this is it. It's either now or never. So he finally consented and had the movie transferred to DVD along with his copy of Nosferatu, and had, you know, so many of them run off at one of those commercial duplicators. And we sat there at the show and, you know, helped them sell the DVDs. And I had an earlier copy of, you know, a Xerox copy of my book that we sold along with that, or you know, along at the table there. So,
well, you had.
I did it. Everybody said, oh, he'll never get him to release the film. Never. Even Robert Wise, the famous director from the Academy, couldn't get him to, you know, put it out, and they offered to do it for free. So finally, this became my, you know, obsession there, was to finally get the thing out and available, which he did.
You had the patience of Job. I know you dedicated the book to Mr. Detlef, but you had tremendous patience in dealing with him. And wasn't there a time when he would even, when he was taking the movie to be shown, that he would even put a gun on top of the movie can?
Yes, that's what Mr. Forrest J. Ackerman, the editor of Famous Monsters magazine, said that when he brought the film out to California. So I guess, yes, I was like Job, and I have the boils to show for it, too.
Well, yeah, I'm so glad that you stuck with it. And
I gave up a couple of times, and we got offered an all-expense-paid trip for the two of us to show the film at the Louvre in Paris.
Ooh.
And I said, oh
my gosh.
And he turned it down. Because of somebody might be videotaping the movie in the theater, and I said, well, they can check everybody, I'll help them go through everybody's clothing and everything, He said, nope, he just refused to do that. So
eventually he
came around and realized just how important the film was, and that he wasn't really going to be making any more money from those clips for the documentaries. Things had changed so much, over the years, and he finally consented and came around at the very end. I was, still even right before the show, we didn't know if he was going to show up or not in New Jersey. So I saw this giant white van with Wisconsin plates, and I said, well, it's happened. This is actually going to finally happen. So
about how old was he when he finally came around and did release it? How long had he been sitting on this film?
Well, he had been sitting on it probably from the early 60s. Didn't really realize its importance until the mid-70s, and then finally in 1980s is when he was starting to get, some money coming in for these documentaries. It's well known that by that time that he actually had the film. And he was in his late 80s. Not late 80s. I guess he's about 83 or so at the time. When he finally came around, and everybody was saying, "Oh man, he'll soon pass on, and we'll just deal with his relatives. It'd be a lot easier." But then his father lived to be over 100 years old, so.
Oh.
And I kept reminding him of that.
Well, these are the fascinating types of things that are found in your book. And I should take some time to give the instructions for the book drawing, because I know that we'll have a lot of listeners interested in entering the book drawing. So it's very simple. If you would like to be a part of the book giveaway for Edison's Frankenstein, just send me an email at realtalk@comcast.net. Now, that Real Talk is spelled R-E-E-L, and Real Talk is all one word. And then put book drawing in the subject line, and I'll enter your name into the drawing. Nikki, maybe you could place that email address in the chat room. Would that be okay? Uh-oh, did we lose Nikki?
No, she's still talking in chat.
I'm here. I did it.
Okay. And you did it.
I did it. Yeah. I was like, okay, should I unmute myself and do it or just do it? No, I did it. I'll do it a couple more times, too.
Thank you. And while we have you, are there any comments or questions that you'd like to share with Fred from the chat?
Well, we were actually having a discussion about how interesting it is when people have a passion for a subject and they decide to write a book about it, just very excited to, how your enthusiasm is contagious to other people, and so we're just excited to read the book. I didn't even realize that it was the anniversary, and so reading a book from somebody who has a passion about a subject always, makes you feel good about it, so we're just very excited to be able to read it, and we're going to have a lot of people in the drawing.
Yeah. Now, what I wanted to say was that since Frankenstein is such a popular, you know, image and everybody is familiar with it, I use that sort of as a springboard to really let people know how movies were actually made at that time. Not much is known about that particular period of the Edison film studio.
Right.
Well, people were mostly interested in, remember him from the very early films where Edison was kind of more involved with the actual production of the movies. And so many of those survived more so than the films that were put out in, say, like 1909 up through 1918. Not many, really, of those films, and there were hundreds of them, really survived the many fires and the recyclings and things like that. The original, the earlier films, like in the 1880s and 90s, and up through, oh, say, like 1905 or so, the reason they survived was so many of them were printed on paper to and sent in for copyright in that manner to the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They printed them on paper to be safer than actually storing all that nitrate film together. So later on, over the years, either from prints that survived or they reconstructed a lot of those movies by re-photographing the paper prints and then putting them together. Now, by the time Frankenstein came out, there were only several frames, four different sections of frames from the film that were used for copyright purposes. The
mm-hmm.
motion picture back then was copyrighted as a photograph, not as an actual moving image. So,
wow. Quite different.
I have a question really quick that we had from chat.
Sure. Yes.
And this might be in your book. I'm not sure, but what is your favorite version of all the Frankensteins?
Oh, that's really rough. Besides this one.
Yes,
yes, of course.
Yeah, I would say would be the 1931 Boris Karloff Frankenstein. I think that's a really great movie. And being the first Frankenstein film with actual sound effects and that really enhanced the laboratory sequences and things. And, you know, I thought Karloff did an excellent job. And
well, but speaking of that, Fred, I had no idea about this actor who played Frankenstein in the Edison's Frankenstein, this Charles Ogle.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt after reading your book that I owe a debt of gratitude to him because I think Boris Karloff adopted, had some makeup, you know, the high forehead, and
yes.
and some of his motions were based on Boris Karloff. And that movie with Boris Karloff is what got me hooked on movies. That's
oh,
the
really?
First. That's the first movie that I remember seeing, and I was so terrified and yet fascinated by that Frankenstein monster that I just became hooked on movies then, and I've never been able to get rid of this addiction to movies. So I have to give Charles Ogle credit for the part he played in my passion for movies. But could you explain a little bit about how about Charles Ogle, some of the things that you know about him and how he played the monster.
Yes, he played the monster more quickly and frantically, moving about fast and full of life and bursting with life, whereas Boris Karloff, he really looked like an animated dead man. You know,
mm-hmm.
he was very slow and zombie-like in the way he walked around at first. Later on, as the film goes on, he develops more and more, whereas Ogle's Frankenstein monster is just created out of these chemicals, and every little piece of him has a life of its own. So he's very full of life and moving around and even jerkily. You know, it's very different from the movie monsters we're used to seeing. So far as the makeup goes, he really created that square-shaped, triangular-shaped forehead, because that would be the piece of appliance that he would have put on that had all the wild hair on it. And some people think that he's actually has a headscarf on, but no, that's the forehead. We'll have to say that seam there is where the two pieces of his head were placed together. Now, what's amazing is that even though the monster is created out of these chemicals in this giant vat, Ogle used the original book and the play versions to make his monster. He looks like he's made out of corpses, you know, because he does. He's, you know, he just looks like he's pieced together, which he is. And he would have done his own makeup at the time.
So he didn't have a makeup artist or
no,
a costume
no,
artist.
No, all the actors did their own makeup at that point. And so by the, you know, by the 30s, the studios pretty much had their own makeup, and the unions made a big difference too. Actors weren't allowed to put on their own makeup by the 30s due to union regulations
right.
and things.
Right. Well, you know, I think we've been neglecting our horror film expert here. So AJ, come on back on, and I know you have some other questions that you'd like to ask Fred, maybe about just the Frankenstein phenomenon entirely.
I do. While we're on the subject of people who have portrayed the monster, you know, a lot of people see the Frankenstein monster as sort of this caricature, and like in the Universal days, as the movies went on, that's how they kind of be. The monster kind of lost his humanity, and as good of actors as Lon Chaney and Bela Lugosi were, they kind of just threw on the head and the electrical bolt and just said, all right, now go attack somebody. There wasn't that much humanity to the character, but for you, which actors have given the best and worst performances as the Frankenstein monster?
Well, I would have to say that Boris Karloff probably gave the best performance as the monster in the first film. The second film,
I agree.
He was very good too, but he was more aware of himself in the second film. Now, probably one of the worst Frankenstein monsters was Bela Lugosi, which is hard for me to say because I love him so much, you know. But that's pretty much why he didn't get the film role of the monster in the first Frankenstein film anyway.
From what I had read, actually, because I had just recently rewatched Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, and a good part of maybe kind of what contributed to his performance not being so good is that originally the monster was supposed to speak in that movie because it followed the ghost of Frankenstein, where Igor's brain was planted into the monster and Bela Lugosi played Igor. But apparently test audiences just laughed too much at his accent coming out of the monster, so they kind of edited out all the references to him having speech or being blind and just had him just kind of wandering around all over the place.
Yeah, he's groping around, and supposedly there is one part where you can actually hear a few seconds of him speaking as the monster. Now, I have to go back and listen to it again to see if that's still in there. But yes, he just didn't seem, and a lot of that in that movie, Bella was had a stand-in, a double, and Lon Chaney Jr. even put on the monster makeup and things for some of the scenes in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman. So I don't mean to tear down of Bela Lugosi. It's just that he's more, you know, he'd be better as the scientist, like he really wanted to be in that first Frankenstein.
Fred, I hate to say this, but I did not like Robert De Niro's performance as Frankenstein in the Kenneth Branagh version, and I'm so surprised because I just think he's a tremendous actor. But what did you think about that performance?
Well, he had too much of his own voice, I thought. If he would have made the voice even stranger, because he would seem very sympathetic as the monster, more like the book, where in the book he's actually a superhuman being, and emotions and his speech and brain and all were superhuman, so that, you know, he was very, very intelligent, And that's how he was able to pick up speech and things like that, just from observing people. But, and De Niro, I thought, did a good job in some respects, but then he just had more of a Brooklyn accent for the monster. And I thought that, you know, Kenneth Branagh always gets to be kind of hammy sometimes, you know.
Oh.
So I thought that the creation sequence, as disgustingly normal as it was, you know, I guess, with all the fluid and things flowing, or amniotic fluid flowing around and all. But what's kind of interesting about it, though, even that harkened back to Edison's Frankenstein, because
yes,
the monster is created in a vault there.
Yes.
And
I saw that, and,
yeah, and
you know,
a little porthole where Branagh is looking in at the monster, and that's just like in where the man is, the doctor is looking at the monster being created in the Edison's Frankenstein.
And I know. And you go ahead.
Yes, and then when there's life being expressed, the way they did it in Edison's Frankenstein is you see the hand of the monster come out between the ironclad doors. And in the whale version, you see Boris Karloff's hand raise up, you know, and it's alive. And then in this Kenneth Branagh version, the monster's hand beats against this porthole window, so... It's
yeah.
still the same kind of thing, you know, is expressed all through those movies, and probably will be from, you know, from now on.
I know, and I like the way you listed some of the actors who played Frankenstein. I had no idea there. You listed about maybe close to 20 actors.
Yeah, and there's probably more, you know, because it seems like a new Frankenstein movie comes out every year. There's another
version
of
right.
it, you know. So
somebody's probably planning one just as we.
I
as
heard
we...
that they were. They're
right.
going to be basing a new Frankenstein movie on a graphic novel that this man named Dignutz or Koontz or something like that did.
Oh.
A series of graphic novels on the Frankenstein monster, and supposedly that's in production right now.
Well, how many movies about the Frankenstein theme have there been so far?
There would be over 100, I'm sure, maybe more. I really, you know, haven't tried to count them up, but I'm sure there's over 100, maybe 200 versions.
Yeah, there were tons of them. You already mentioned that your favorite was probably the 1933 version. So,
31.
Aside from just the actors and the portrayals in general, as overall film quality goes, I hate to do it to you, but I got to ask you, are there any really memorable stinkers for you, some of the ones that might be good because they were just so bad, some of the really
memorable
treatments of Frankenstein?
Frankenstein's Daughter, I don't know if you remember that, was one of those kind of like teenage Frankenstein-type movies. And yeah, there's a whole lot of Frankenstein and the Space Monster and... Lady Frankenstein with Joseph Cotten as Dr. Frankenstein. It's
really?
Classic horrible movie, yeah. I'm into those horrible campy movies as well. So.
Then there was like the Godzilla-type one, Frankenstein Conquers the World.
Conquers the Universe. Yes, with Nick Adams. Not as a monster, but yeah.
And even though Betty Jo might like it more, there was one called Frankenstein Sings.
A Frankenstein musical?
Oh,
I've
yeah.
I've never heard of that. I probably would.
For good reason,
that.
Betty Jo, for good reason.
Well, the original...
Fred just gave me a terrible flashback because I believe that some time ago I actually did see Frankenstein and the Space Monster, and my brain had been desperately trying to block that out.
I'm sorry.
Well, wait a minute. Frankenstein sang in Young Frankenstein. The Peter Boyle.
That's different, yes. That's
putting on the Ritz. So
the
that
original,
the
original
yep,
play
on the
Ritz, version.
That's right.
The original
Fred,
play version.
This is something that whenever we have AJ on over the years, we've had this discussion. It's always nice to hear from somebody else. There are, you know, lots of different monster movies, but there's a few themes that have stayed popular and just run the distance. And as you say, they just keep making them. They come back over and over again. Frankenstein is certainly one of them, along, you know, like with the Wolfman and Dracula. What do you think it is about the Frankenstein story that gives it such legs? Why does it retain popularity over, well, a century now?
Well, it's a universal thing about, you know, us creating life. And then when you get to the crux of it, you know, did God create life and then abandon us? Or has he been, you know, around us all the time? And Mary Shelley really got into those kind of themes and the responsibility of creating a life and not, you know, taking care of it is what really came back to haunt Dr. Frankenstein. I mean, in the book, the monster kills all of Frankenstein's friends and his family and has him put in jail and accused of murder. And, you know, it's a very horrible thing that's usually not carried out through the films. You know, it was to an extent in the Brenau film. But every film version of the book changes things. Even the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is not really Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I mean, it's, you know.
Well, the original book was more of a philosophical treatment.
Oh, yes.
About it, wasn't it? I mean, it really
Oh, yes.
dealt with the big issues of life and death and mortality and creation. And so many of the films get carried away with the special effects and the whole idea of the rawr monster and the bolts
yeah.
of the head. And a lot of what Shelley wrote really gets left behind, don't you think?
Yeah, it's the monster being the outsider, not being able to converse with humanity or be part of it. I mean, just because he's so ugly, you know, he's
right.
not the type that fits in, you know, that's kind of fits in with what society is looking for in a person. You know, even though he would be emotionally and mentally and physically much superior to the regular humans, but he was kind of weird looking, you know, so just didn't quite fit in that way. And that kind of does get lost in the, you know, in the movies, because they just don't have the monster and the doctor sitting down and debating about it. And
well,
also,
we're still getting a lot of votes before Betty Jo brings us down to the closing stretch here in the
okay.
chat. As Nikki will tell you, not so much a question. We're still getting a lot of votes from Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. That seems to be one of the most popular films, even though it was sort of a spoof, you know.
Right. Well, what's funny about that is when you're looking at the brains in the jars in Young Frankenstein,
yeah.
you'll see one that says Ogle on it.
Oh, for Charles Ogle.
Yes, for Charles Ogle, and it says,
Holy cow.
I think it says as an explorer or something like that. Yeah, if you look closely, you know, it might be more in, I think it's at the doctor's, not at the school where, you know, Abby Normal Brain is stolen. It's one of those sections where you see, it looks like it says Ogle on the brain.
Oh, so they did some research into the history,
yeah.
a little Easter egg in there for us. I
yeah,
never knew
about that. It might be pushed a little bit on my part, but I'm hoping that's what it says. Kind of hard
well,
to
Fred,
see. So.
Yeah. Oh, I just love that, doing a homage to Charles Ogle.
Yes.
Well, Fred, other than entering our book drawing, where can listeners obtain a copy of your book and the Edison film?
Well, you can send me a message at Fred Weibel, Weibel, at AOL.com, and I'll be very glad to let people know how to get different versions of the book. Just let me say that I think that I'm very happy and proud that Bear Manor Media took a chance on putting this book out, because, you know, nobody really knows how much interest there's going to be in a, you know, in a book about the 1910 Frankenstein, but I tried to make the book as entertaining as I could and throw in a lot of the history of how films were made at the time. So I'm hoping that people will enjoy it.
Oh, it's a great book, and any movie fan just would love to read this book, because it's got so much about how movies are made and the work that you went through to discover it and restore it and make it available for people, and so much in it about the whole Frankenstein theme. So I recommend that listeners who are movie fans get a copy of your book. Is there anything else you'd like to add about Edison's Frankenstein?
No, only that I would hope that someday somebody will actually do a full restoration job on the film, really bring it up to look like it did in 1910. You know, what I could do was just what somebody could do on their home computer. You know, but you'd have to go frame by frame through the movie and clean it up and all. So, but it's still enjoyable, and it's Frankenstein misshapen self. You know, it's continues to live on despite all the you know, the destruction properties of nature and people. So, what can I say? I think we're very lucky that this film has survived at all. Maybe hopefully they'll turn up another copy somewhere.
Well, you can't keep a good monster down or a good monster film down. And isn't it amazing that the original story was written by a young woman, 19 years old? Am I correct about that?
I wish I could have written like that when I was 19. So.
So do I. I think that's just incredible that she had such insight into this whole theme
on the 200th anniversary of that, so in, you know, another 8 years.
Particularly in an era where women were expected to be young ladies and shouldn't be dealing with creepy, scary things, you know, and it was you know, more of a genteel society, so.
Well, she was around with some oddball people, that's for sure.
Yes, she was.
I haven't figured them out at all.
No, the company she was keeping would probably lead her to write a book like this. Well, I see our time is almost up, Fred, so I want to thank you so much for being such a fascinating guest, and congratulations on your amazing work in connection with Edison's Frankenstein. We just give you our very best wishes for the success of your wonderful book.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being on. It was quite a pleasure.
It's been such fun having you on our show, and I hope that many of our listeners get a chance to read Edison's Frankenstein. This is Betty Jo Tucker.
And you are giving away some copies, aren't you?
Yes, and we are giving away 3 copies, and we thank Bear Manor.
Well, they better read it at least.
That's right, and we thank Bear Manor. I'm sure they will.
Okay.
We thank your publisher for the generosity of giving us these 3 books to give away. This is Betty Jo Tucker giving a big shout-out to the folks at Blog Talk Radio for all their support in connection with this show. Special thanks, of course, to Nikki and Jazz for everything they do to make Movie Attic Headquarters so much fun. And today, thanks to Fred and AJ for helping us celebrate the 100th anniversary of Edison's classic film. The email address again for our giveaway of Fred's book is realtalk@comcast.net. That's RealTalk. Thanks also to our chatters and other listeners. We really appreciate you. Please come back on Tuesday, March 30th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, when our guests will be the United Kingdom teenagers who found a forgotten Jules Verne novel and are planning to produce the film version. Their backers include Ian McKellen, Rowan Atkinson, Stephen Fry, and Jude Law. In the meantime, remember to check out our film reviews at realtalkreviews.com. That's R-E-E-L, realtalkreviews.com. And don't forget to do what you can to support Gary King's film musical, which he talked about on last week's show. In fact, to close the show today, I'll be tapping away to the short tune written by Joe Sherman to explain the need for help with Gary's movie. And here it is now.
So we're through with hacking,
and we're done with slacking. So now the best we need is some financial backing.
And now we're humming,
this tune is becoming quite clear. We're on to something big. Forgive our persistence, but if we manage to knock down your bristling resistance, won't you make us so nervous with some cash to preserve us? For it's back till my food service gig.
Bye. Bye for now, movie fans. Thanks for listening.